Stutes Administrator v. Marion Lifesaving Crew et al., Mary Lynn Tate, Appellant's Counsel, John L. M. White, Appellee's Counsel.
Before we start, let's make sure that we haven't lost theirs, Justice Mims. Okay, I didn't want to lose you. All right, Ms. Tate, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, the issues that bring us here today are straightforward. One is the meaning of good faith in the Good Samaritan statute. One is the meaning of the word compensation in the Good Samaritan statute. But there's an overarching third issue that is one of public policy. The legislature enshrined in the law, in the Healthcare Decisions Act, the public policy recognition that life is sacred and the sanctity of life and continuing life is to be honored at all costs. But at the same time, also enshrined in that legislation is the individual right to specify and control conditions, treatments, life-extending interventions at the end of life. And we deal with the key tool in that basket in this case. And that is the advanced medical directive. In this case, the decedent, Mr. Stutes, executed an advanced directive in December of 2013, with no idea that a couple of months later it would be reviewed. And in this case, Marion Lifesaving Crew sent two MTs to his home after he became unresponsive, had labored breathing, and the family, recognizing the need for intervention, called for an ambulance. EMTs Thompson and Paul responded to the residents, and upon their arrival, Rebecca Stutes, the sister of the decedent, gave them a copy of his advance directive. They chose not to read it. EMT Thompson looked at it, saw that there was a signature, and then he said, "We've got to go. I don't have time to read this." So he handed it back to her. She was designated medical agent in that advance directive, and she immediately said, "No, he's not DNR," after Thompson made that declaration. She said, "He wants to be resuscitated. I'm his medical agent under this directive. Please, please treat him." They put him in the ambulance, started to the hospital, and Mr. Thompson watched him die. As we look at the definition of good faith that would negate immunity under the statute and analyze the facts here, no matter what the definition, these facts cannot meet good faith.
Can I, this is Justice Kelsey, Ms. Tate, may I interject right there? No matter the definition, assume without conceding anything that the use of good use of gross negligence four times in the exact statute as an exception to the otherwise blanket good faith immunity. Assume without conceding anything that that means that gross negligence can never be bad faith unless the statute says it. So assume that. If you go to the next level, we're looking at willful and wanton, you know, an intentional tort-like thing. Is this case, under your estimation, at that level, if that were the legal standard, which I know you don't agree it is?
This case is at that level. Mr. Thompson, and continuing with what would be included in good faith, he didn't read the medical directive saying he didn't have time, curiously, yet he had already decided it was a DNR and he had no need to be in a hurry. He didn't recognize the difference between the directive and a DNR. He didn't listen to the medical agent when she said, "No, he's not DNR." He didn't ask to have it back to read it again. He refused to read it. He didn't respond to her when she said he was wrong. He didn't respond to her when she said, "Treat him, he's not DNR." He didn't follow the medical agent's directive. He refused to read it. He refused to resuscitate. He violated state statute and medical orders from the medical director of the crew when he did not call. He did not call the crew chief. He did not call the medical director, Dr. Bruzzo. He did not call the emergency room except to tell them that this gentleman was DNR. There was never a DNR present. And under the statutory scheme, including the Healthcare Decisions Act, he was ordered not to make a call of DNR unless he had in his hand a valid DNR signed by a physician.
May I follow up, Ms. Tate?
Of course.
Am I right? This went off on a plea and bar, so the trial judge is actually having an evidentiary hearing, correct?
So the trial judge decided the immunity issues on a plea and bar with stipulated facts. There are no factual disputes here. And the trial court was aware of all these failures. The trial court was aware, because it's in the fact statements, that Mr. Thompson did not read. He said, I don't have time to read it, and he handed it back to her. In doing so, he violated the statute. He violated doctor's orders.
I follow that. The thing I'm trying to get at that I'm confused about is, typically in a plea and bar, when there is an evidentiary presentation, witnesses, documents, stipulations, whatever, the trial judge does make fact findings and have the deference accorded to it. So assuming, again, you've conceded nothing, assuming gross negligence is not enough to overcome, gross negligence is not the same as bad faith, it's something much higher, are we to apply on this fact pattern the deferential test? Could a reasonable fact finder conclude that willful and wanton or intentional level misconduct was not proven here, as opposed to what I think you're saying, which is, well, it may be sufficient. Some fact finder could have found that. So do you see what I'm trying to figure out?
I believe I do, Justice Kelsey. No reasonable fact finder could have concluded under these circumstances that these crew members acted in good faith under any definition. The court, in reviewing this matter, gave definitions. He required that there be a showing of fraud and dishonesty and bad faith. This conduct is clearly bad faith. This conduct is clearly dishonest for not honoring their obligation to read a medical directive. The court correctly found that this is gross negligence and said so on multiple occasions, but no deference is required here because the court is reviewing de novo, in this case, the application of the statute to the facts and the interpretation of the statute. So the lower court simply gave the wrong definition to good faith and allowed these crew members to choose death for Mr. Stutes when they had no right to do so. In addition, Your Honor, the trial court misconstrued compensation. Compensation is money paid. This compensation was not reimbursement for expenses. The defendants admitted they incurred no expenses for which they sought reimbursement. They admitted that they were paid, two of them were paid, Mr. Chatham and Mr. Powell were paid on a scheme of incentive pay. In order to get pay per shift, they had to work three, quote, volunteer shifts. But those three shifts were part of the consideration to earn the pay on the fourth and subsequent shifts. They were paid. But the entity, Marion Lifesaving Crew, was a licensed EMS entity under Virginia law and regulations, an insured entity. They had these members working for them, and this entity billed for this service, received payment for this service, and under the law is not entitled to any immunity for this service. No matter which paragraph you look at in 225, the Good Samaritan statute, this entity is not entitled to immunity. To give it absolute immunity under the facts before this particular court is to misconstrue the law, misapply to facts, and fail to recognize facts. In addition, because these crew members were agents, they are also liable. Mr. Chatham and Mr. Powell received payment, and they received that payment in exchange for services rendered. And at this point, Your Honor, may I now reserve my remaining time for rebuttal?
4 minutes and 58 seconds. Ms. White?
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. Anyone who has ever had to get volunteers to do anything knows that it's really hard to get people to volunteer for things, especially if there's any risk attached to it. Communities, especially small rural ones like in Smith County, depend on volunteers to provide vital services like emergency medical services. In fact, Marion, the town of Marion, had designated this now non-existent, but when it did exist, nonprofit organization as their designated first responder, emergency medical service responder, because they didn't have one themselves. That's that's how integral volunteer organizations are to small communities. So the dispute in this case surrounds the definition of good faith, and then whether there was compensation given. Clear case law, this court's clear cases in the Rafalco case, citing to the Lovett case, have said that good faith or bad faith is a factual finding decided based on the court's determination of the mindset of the parties. And in other contexts, in the UCC context, has defined good faith as a subjective test. And that makes sense in this statute, whereas just—
Counsel. This
yes.
is Justice Mims. Your opposing counsel cites CUNA, Mutual Insurance Society versus Norman, which has a reasonableness standard for good faith. Is there any precedent or doctrine that would prevent us from applying the insurance standard to this particular fact pattern?
So, Your Honor, it doesn't make sense in the context of this statute, because as Justice Kelsey pointed out, this statute uses the terms in separate sections, gross negligence and willful and wanton negligence, which the court has described gross and willful wanton as degrees of negligence. Section one of the statute immunizes for any civil liability. And
counsel, What I'm really driving at is that you are, both on brief and in this argument, are using the UCC and telling us that we can pull from Title 8.1 in order to determine what good faith is here. And if, in fact, you are asserting that we can borrow from the UCC, why can't we also borrow, or why couldn't we alternatively borrow from Title 38.1? That's the nature of this particular question.
Correct, Your Honor. And what I was getting to is it doesn't make any sense in the context of this statute to borrow a reasonableness standard, because what this statute does is immunizing in Section 1 for any civil liability. And 99.9% of civil liability is just negligence. It's plain old negligence. And I would submit the General Assembly wouldn't create a statute to immunize against any civil liability if then they meant to exempt plain negligence. That would make no sense. That would eviscerate pretty much all protection under the statute. So we would submit that having good faith be a reasonableness standard doesn't make any sense, because then essentially you would have no immunity there. And also in that insurance good faith, bad faith test, what you are still measuring is a decision of an insurance adjuster or an insurance company to look at certain facts and say there's coverage here or there's not coverage here, or we're not going to offer this amount. You are still looking at decision. I think that's where the faith part comes in. What is you know, what is the faith being applied there? And so in the bad faith insurance context, there are cases that say you measure that decision by whether it's reasonable based upon the facts you know it, but you're still measuring a decision. And so that's how I think you synthesize them. But it can't just be a plain reasonableness standard, because it just wouldn't make sense in the context of this statute where it mentions other degrees of negligence in other parts of the statute.
But Ms. White, this is Justice Kelsey. Assume for the sake of the question, bad faith does not equal negligence. Bad faith does not equal gross negligence. Is that, what else is there? That does clearly leave intentional torts, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, as the circuit court decided, you know, dishonesty or you know, fraud, basically, which would be intentional torts.
So the question then is, could this fact pattern be sufficient to establish an intentional tort of some kind?
No, absolutely not, Your Honor. So the facts, the recitation that we were treated to in the first part of the argument, I would urge the court to go back and look at the actual stipulated facts within that are contained within the joint appendix. The facts as stipulated in the plaintiff's stipulation of facts, we offer two, both were stipulations that the court was to look at, but we offered, they're two separate documents. But what the plaintiff offered was that Mr. Thompson testified that he looked at the front and back page, saw that it was signed, noted no extraordinary methods on page two, but then said, you know, we got to go. We don't have time. That a representation that the advance directive was not read, that's inaccurate. Those facts involve reading. They involve looking, noting no extraordinary measures. That is the act of reading. And then, you know, mistakenly believing that it was a do not resuscitate order.
Counsel, yes. This is Justice Mims again. I agree with you that the purpose of all of these provisions of the Good Samaritan Act is to immunize negligence. A Good Samaritan comes upon a car collision and pulls somebody out of a car, and in the process they become paralyzed, for example. It would have been negligence to do so if you were a trained, a compensated medical professional, but in this instance you're not. So that's just one example of hundreds that I could think of. The refusal to read a document and the conclusion that the document says something that it simply doesn't say doesn't really fit within the four corners of negligence. I don't know where along the continuum. I mean, if it doesn't fit within the four corners of negligence, then it also doesn't fit within the continuum of gross negligence or willful and wanton. It seems that this is sui generis. This is the sort of case that the legislature never contemplated. And I think that's why we're struggling with it. That's why perhaps you're inviting us to borrow from the UCC. The other council is inviting us to borrow from the insurance code. Take it completely out of negligence. Just leave that aside, if you will, for purposes of this question. It's not yet a question. It's really a diatribe at this moment. But the question is, if it in fact is outside of the negligence continuum, then why does your client prevail?
So, Your Honor, I would say there was no refusal to read the document. The facts as stipulated in this case, they read the document. They mistakenly read the document. So it just is that I understand your question, and the question, which is the same, similar to Justice Kelsey's question, is would an intentional tort be bad faith? Yes, an intentional tort would be bad faith. One, that's not what is pled in this case. If you look at plaintiff's complaint, she did not plead an intentional tort. What is pled is negligence. The only duty that plaintiff pleads in her complaint is contained in paragraph 4, which said that the EMTs had a duty to render emergency services. So if this is not an intentional tort, and the facts as stipulated again are not intentional. They looked at the document. They saw, you know, parts of it were signed. They noted, they read the part that said no extraordinary measures. That is a stipulated fact. They did read it. They just misinterpreted what the document was.
Counsel, I don't want to spend too much time on what's clearly in the joint appendix and the transcript. But looking at joint appendix page 460, he says he didn't have time to read it, so I just handed it back to her. I'm pushing back on your statement that he read it, but he misunderstood it.
Yes, Your Honor, and that is, it was also, he did say that, and he also said that he looked at the front and back and noted that there were no extraordinary methods on page 2. So, yes, when he said, I didn't have time to read it, I interpret that as I didn't go and...
Counsel, I think you're now muted.
I apologize. He did continue. He did also say that he looked at the front and back and noted on page 2 that there were no extraordinary methods checked. So, he did say in a colloquial sense that that he didn't have time to read it. I interpret that as didn't have time to read the whole thing. He looked at the parts that he thought were important, mistakenly, and then continued from there because it was an emergency situation. What this statute is designed to protect are those calls, those judgment calls that the EMTs are forced to make in emergency situations. That's why the legislature created this statute and afforded them in section 1 immunity from any civil liability, and used that very broad term because they wanted to protect those judgment calls in these emergency situations. I just want to move on to the compensation part, because that's the second part, is that none of the three individual EMTs were paid for this date, February 9th, 2014. One of them never received not a dime from the life-saving crew ever. One was not supposed to be on call that day, and so didn't mark it as a volunteer shift or a paid shift. And the third clearly marked it, and there's documentation in the appendix that this was a volunteer shift. So none of them were paid for the day.
Counsel, why wouldn't your opposing counsel's view of the compensation scheme be correct, that in order to get paid during that month, they have to basically give up three shifts, which, if you think about it, the argument that then figures into the compensation, why is that not an appropriate way to look at this method of payment?
Your Honor, because what the statute looks at is very, that specific moment in time is so for those particular services, that's the moment that the statute looks at. It says, that's the relevant time period. The statute immunizes specific actions, the act of rendering care to any ill or injured person. So it's that particular act of rendering care at that moment that we must look at. And that they later may have done two or three other shifts didn't change the fact that on that day, that care they rendered in that moment was not compensated.
I would not argue with you with regard to their looking at the activity or inactivity for that day. But my question is a little bit broader with regard to a compensation scheme, I think, as allowed by opposing counsel, that after three shifts, the payment for that month, in essence, covers all of the work that they did that month.
So So, Your Honor, the way that the system that they set up is that they assigned a particular value to the shifts after three. And so one person just did the three, and then the others had the option to do others, but it was not a command to do more than that. And so the shifts only obtain value after you did three, not that somehow the three were part of the value. But the statute contains an exception for salary of personnel, which we, in our brief, we submit this could be construed as salary of personnel, these payments to them. I see my time has expired.
I have a question about that. May I, Mr. Chief Justice?
Absolutely.
Are these EMTs considered public personnel?
So, yes, I have two responses to that, Justice Powell. One is that I read the or as disjunctive in that clause, so it just says or personnel. But two, yes, I believe they would be considered public personnel because, as I started off saying, and is in our stipulation of facts, is that they were the designated emergency response services for the county, and this call came through the 911 response system. So in this case, yes, I believe they would be public personnel.
Justice Powell, is that a satisfactory answer?
Yes, Chief, it is an answer. Thank you.
All right. Your time has expired. Ms. Tate, you have 4 minutes and 58 seconds remaining for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. First, with respect to risk of these EMTs, paragraph 6 of this statute specifically immunizes them if they give cardiopulmonary resuscitation mistakenly thinking that there was no DNR. So the risk goes in the other direction. And to call this action of not reading and not abiding by the directive a judgment call is a new argument. It's never been made. And in fact, these crew members had no discretion. Every step was dictated by the doctor's orders, especially the last step, which is if in doubt, resuscitate. They disobeyed that order, and they also, whatever they did to review this document, they admit they didn't read it. But in fact, and Judge Alexander found as a fact, the second page nowhere mentions no extraordinary measures. In fact, there's no doctor's signature. There must be a doctor's signature on a DNR. These crew members were reckless. They were reckless in finding that this was a DNR. They could see the cover, they could read the title, Virginia Advanced Directive. In addition, these employees, Chatham and Powell, were paid compensation. They received 1099s, not salaries, and a 1099 on its face says non-employee compensation.
Ms.
The
Tate,
compensation issue.
Ms. Tate, would you agree with counsel that they are public personnel?
Yes.
Okay.
They are. And they have, their behavior has also erased any sovereign immunity they might have through the county under which they were providing these services. Mindset for good faith is not determinative. In fact, I provided case law in the reply brief indicating that the circumstances surrounding conduct reflect the intention of the person, and especially here, conduct was distinct, specific. They did not read, they did not recognize, they did not listen to the agent.
Ms. Tate,
yes.
May I take you back to E? So under E, if they're compensated, if they receive salaries, their compensation does not count if they are public personnel. So your argument, I believe from your brief, is that these monies were not salaries? You're looking at the definition of salaries?
They are not salaries. They were paid under the ledger heading of professional services, and they were paid based on whether they earned shifts. Salary wasn't mentioned until the appellee's brief in this case, never mentioned to the trial court. The compensation paid was an incentive pay scheme, And they were paid compensation that were not public employee salaries. In fact, the 1099s disowned them as employees. It says non-employee income. In addition, the reasonableness standard is essential, I believe, for this definition. And
Ms. Tate, I'm not sure I'm following this last point. I know you're running out of time, but if the intent of the statute is to protect volunteers, it wouldn't make much logical sense to say, well, we'll protect you, but only if you get paid a salary, because if you just get a trifling reimbursement here and there, we're not going to protect you, even though that's much closer to being a volunteer than someone getting $80,000 a year salary. So, I mean, that just strikes me as almost upside down. I'm not sure if I'm misunderstanding what you're saying.
Your Honor, the statute protects persons who are volunteers, not paid compensation. These crew members, two of them were paid compensation, and the entity was paid compensation, no questions asked. It's the volunteer who gets protected, and that's the purpose of the statute. Only if they act in good faith, and that means reasonable, in my view.
Don't let me put words in your mouth. This is very important, but you are saying that they are other public officers. I'm sorry. You are saying that, quote, there are other public officials or personnel who render such emergency service under E, end quote. Is that right?
I don't understand your question, Justice Kelsey. What I'm saying is that these crew members received compensation. The entity had only one salaried employee, and that was the crew chief. This compensation negates their volunteerism and negates their immunity entitlement under this statute.
My question is very basic, but I think it's going to the same thing that Justice Kelsey is asking and that I asked. Are you drawing a distinction between compensation of folks who receive a 1099 and salaries?
Yes, ma'am. There is a distinction. 1099 is non-employee compensation. The ledger produced by defendants labeled it professional services. Under these circumstances, these two crew members received compensation and are not entitled to immunity. But overall,
non-employees, and I'm sorry, but I'm just hung up on this language of E. If they are non-employees, are they public personnel?
They are public only for the purpose of being clothed with the county's sovereign immunity protection. And the trial court's finding of gross negligence takes them outside that immunity protection. Any other questions?
Justice Powell, Justice Kelsey?
Not for me.
No, thanks.
Here we have a situation where good faith cannot be applied to any of this conduct. Not reading, refusing to listen, refusing to accept the word of the agent. They would have known she was the agent had they in fact read the medical directive. The reckless decision to usurp a medical directive here is just astonishing and cannot be tolerated here. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Tate. Your time has expired. This hearing of the Supreme Court is concluded.